What if you were born with a disease that you always knew would kill you? And then what if all of a sudden you were given a second chance? Well, that's exactly what happened to me. And it's the question that we explore on the new podcast series, Breathless, from Snack Labs. Join me, Jeremy Saunders, for a series that explores what it means to live and die, to love and to lose, and what it's like to have your whole life turned upside down and the unexpected challenges that come with a life-saving drug. You can listen to Breathless now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, folks. Jeremy here of Turn Me On Podcast of the E1 Podcast Network. And I'm currently sans Bridie, but I wanted to start this week's episode off with a little preamble, just kind of explaining a few things. First off, right off the bat, I want to give a huge, huge shout out, a huge thank you to Hillary Windsor and to Vice Canada for publishing this really, really kick-ass article in Vice this week about Turn Me On Podcast, about what Bridie and I are up to. And I'm sure that there's a lot of new listeners who are tuning in this week for the very first time. So first of all, welcome. Thank you for tuning in. We really appreciate it. The other thing I wanted to throw out there is that, I got a little bit of bad news. I got a little bit of unfortunate news. So some of you may or may not know this, but, Bridie has been away for the month of July. She's been living on the beautiful island of Prince Edward, and she's been the production manager on this really cool feature film that they're shooting on the island, this comedy that's going to come out. It's called Wharf Rats. It sounds fucking hysterical. I can't wait to watch it. But since she's been away, we haven't been able to come together to record an episode for this week. So what we decided to do was this week we are going to redrop one of our favorite episodes from last season. It is the episode where we sat down with Dr. Marianne Fisher. She is a PhD whose specialty surrounds the topic of intrasexual competition, specifically between women. It was a really fascinating conversation, and I figured, hey, if we're going to have a whole bunch of people tuning in for the first time, why not throw out some of our best shit for you to first tune into? And if you already listened to that episode, I highly suggest going back and listening to it again. I tuned in today just to be sure that this was the one that we wanted to choose. And I took even more away from it than the first time we had the conversation. So I hope you all enjoy it so much, and as always, really, really appreciate each and every one of you who tune in every single week. Bridie is on her way back to Halifax as we speak. She'll be home basically as this episode airs. So we will be back next week with a normal episode, continuing things as we usually do. But we'll go on forward with this come again segment with a little repeat episode. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll talk soon. Ready to talk about some sex?
Let's do it.
Sweet. This week's episode is going to be really fun. We talked to a professional, a sex professional.
Yeah, an evolutionary psychologist.
It's always fun. Always fun to have those little treats of episodes where you talk to someone who like really, really knows what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it's extremely intimidating.
For this foreplay, I'm just going to apologize if I sound real nasally and heady and throaty. Those all make sense, right?
Yeah.
I'm sick. I feel like I'm getting sick like all the time when we record these foreplays.
And if I sound cranky, it's because I am.
Are you on your period?
No, but thanks for asking. That's a lot of people are not going to like that. I'm in my premenstrual phase, so I'm premenstrual right now.
You know I'm joking, right?
My period calendar says I have 7 days to go, so that's it probably has something to do with that. Oh, man.
I don't care if anybody else didn't find that funny. I know that you did a little because you laughed. People can't see that. Oh, they can hear it.
Oh, man.
Want to hear something funny, though? This is fucking weird. It has nothing to do with your period, I promise. The other day, so we had the screening of the Sick Boy documentary the other day, and it was here in Halifax, and it went really, really well. People loved it. Before the screening, I go into the bathroom because I have to pee. You know, I want to get all that pee out. I don't want to have to get up and go pee in the middle of the movie. So I go to pee.
You peed blood clots?
No, I did not. I didn't.
Did you pee out a baby?
No. But I go to pee in the urinal, and as I'm doing it, it's a very busy bathroom. Oh, God, sorry. And this gentleman comes up beside me, and he starts relieving himself next to me. And, you know, I'm looking at the board in front of me, and he's looking at the board in front of him. And I never have the, like, urge to be like, hey, what's the guy next to me packing? I've never been that guy to, like, take a peek. But we both kind of finish peeing at the same time. And I noticed something that I've never seen someone do before. And it made me think about, like, all of the things that I do differently from everybody else when it comes to, like, my junk and my butthole.
Yeah.
But this guy, the way he finished relieving himself.
He stuck his finger up his butthole?
No. Yeah. So, like,
just press down on the bladder and squish the rest of it out?
Well, okay. So I don't know about you and your kind, Bridie, with a vagina. But when I've been finished peeing my whole life, and most men that I know, there's like a little sort of... what would you call it? Like a
I've heard about
a ceremony that you perform to like make sure all the pee is out. So most guys will like pull their foreskin back and forth two or three times just to get all the drips off. I have this thing where I kind of do that, or like I'll shake a little, or but to make sure all the pee
tap
is out.
Tap it on the side of the urinal. Yeah.
Dunk dunk dunk. all clear. So what I do is I take my thumb and I run it along the underside of my gooch, and it like kind of just pushes the pee out. Well, this guy, I don't know what he did to do that, but like instead of doing the shake or the pull back and forth, he took his fingers and he literally flicked his head like three aggressive times, like that. And I almost went, ah. out of like phantom pain beside this gentleman.
How did you see that if you weren't looking at it?
Well, my peripheral vision, I have...
It's extensive?
I have very perfect vision. And my peripheral vision is just, you know, beyond most humans.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to catch exactly what this guy did. But like, have you ever heard of someone doing that? Literally striking the head of his dick. Like, that would hurt. Would that not hurt?
I don't know. Maybe he doesn't have any feeling down there.
Man, that would hurt me.
I'm trying to think of what my technique is. Because for sure, I feel like if I tilt my pelvis a certain way, there's like still some pee that hasn't come out of the funnel yet.
Oh, so you do pelvic tilt?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, a little bit. Or just kind of like start to like put my weight into my feet a little more.
See, I do like that thing with my thumb running up the gooch.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to me sort of doing a Kegel. And that forces the last bits of pee out. God, I wonder how many people are listening to this going, what
does this have to do with what? Anything? Well, I learned something there because I've heard of the problem of not getting it all out and then having like pee on your leg later.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's the worst. Yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That just sounds awful.
Maybe I'll start flicking the head.
Maybe see what happens. Try it.
Yeah.
Flick it on the urinal.
Marianne Fisher is going to listen to this and be like, why are they talking to that about that?
She probably knows because she's an evolutionary psychologist.
Yeah, she knows why the guy who flicks his head is going to go further in life than me, who runs his thumb along the gooch.
But she did talk about some really cool things about how we compete against each other for mates.
Mm.
Maybe that's some kind of mating...
Some
call
primal,
of the wild
primal mating ritual thing. Mm-hmm. Either that, flicking the head, running the finger on the gooch, or slamming the head on the ceramic.
Yeah, or what about just
blow down
practicing
on it?
It'd be good for you, anyone with a lung problem.
Yeah. All right. Okay. That's just fucking stupid. Let's move it along. We have a bit of a brain boner. It's a little more serious this week.
Mm-hmm.
And man, boy, is it a doozy, a tough one.
Yeah.
Do you want to hit that one, Brad?
Yeah, I sure will. This is from Ginny in Ohio. I think that's what OH stands for, yes?
You got me.
Okay, great.
OH, Ohio? Yeah, sure.
All
I
right.
think so.
Oh, she's from O. Hey, Bridie and Jeremy. I have my own little brain boner for you. Unfortunately, it's more serious than sexy, but I've really enjoyed the way in which you have approached some of the more serious topics on your show, and I think this would be a great topic to talk about on the podcast. Recently, in the United States where I live, an issue has come to light. People, usually men, removing their condoms halfway through sex, most Ew. Often without their partner's permission. Uh-oh. This is called stealthing. And a woman wrote a paper regarding the topic in the Columbia Journal of Gender and Law. She describes this phenomenon as rape adjacent, arguing that the act is a form of gender-based violence which finds its origins in misogyny and toxic masculinity. It is an act performed without consent, with a very real consequences of pregnancy and STIs. Such an act also makes its victims feel violated and powerless. She also highlights that there's a whole online community of men who consciously do this, thinking that they have the right to spread their seed. I've included a link to this paper below. I read it. It's pretty upsetting. I bring this up because I myself have had this experience. I had just started seeing a man to whom I was super attracted and who I liked a lot. This happened around the second time we had sex. Both of us were very in the moment, and he put a condom on as I was not on any form of birth control. I'd told him as much and thought I'd made it clear we needed to use condoms. We started having sex and it was fantastic, but his penis went soft a couple of minutes in. I told him that it didn't matter and that we could continue foreplay until he was ready. He said to hold on, he just needed to pee, so he ran to the bathroom. When he came back, we picked up where we left off. It wasn't too long before he came. He suddenly had this panicked look on his face and I asked why. I assumed he put a condom back on before resuming sex, but he told me that he hadn't and had finished inside me.
Oh, God.
I can't emphasize how violated I felt that he had betrayed my trust, knowing I was not on birth control. There was a whole slew of emotions I was feeling, all horrible. His response was to apologize profusely, run to the store for Plan B, and make me breakfast, which was fine, but it shouldn't have happened in the first place. Almost worse than the actual act was the way he behaved the rest of the day, as if he was the one hurt by what had happened, and he needed my constant comfort and validation that I wasn't mad. I was livid, but I felt like I had to pretend it wasn't a big deal, that it was all okay. I don't know why he removed the condom. When I asked, he just answered that he didn't know. My assumption is that he was embarrassed in some way that he kept losing his erection, something that is totally normal and that I did not care about in any way. I know that what I experienced was wrong, but I never categorized it as sexual assault until my best friend showed me this paper on stealthing. After I read that, I struggled with my feelings about the experience all over again. It's really hard to wrap my head around the fact that I was sexually assaulted by a man that I liked, trusted, and respected at the time, especially since I fell in love with him and he became my boyfriend a couple of months later. I think this is one of the biggest discussions to have about sexual assault, that it isn't usually committed by a stranger in a dark alley, but by people that we know, trust, and maybe even love. I think people need to be better educated about what is right and what isn't, so they are able to recognize sexual assault and rape rather than just thinking of it as bad sex. Anyway, I bring this up in the hopes that you may touch on this topic on your podcast, which is fabulous. I could also use some advice on how to broach talking about this experience, which happened 9 months ago, with my partner, the same one who stealthed. I feel that it's really important to bring this up, identify it for what it is, and talk about the way it made me feel. It's just been a long time since it happened, and I know he's going to react by being guilty and hurt. I don't want that. I just want a recognition that the experience we had together was wrong. I'd appreciate any advice you have for me. Thank you so much for your time and for the fantastic podcast. Ginny.
Man. Well, I just want to say straight, like, first off, right off the bat, that is fully sexual assault, rape adjacent sexual assault, however you want to put it. Like, that is assault. Sexual assault is doing something without consent, mm-hmm. without another person's consent. And that is exactly that. I did a little bit of reading before we kind of dived into this, and, Canada and Switzerland have both, brought people to court and have, what would you call that when they, having a brain fart here, when they like sentence someone, there we go. Mm-hmm. That's it. Have sentenced people for, doing this act of stealthing. Yet it is not something that has been brought to court and sentenced in the US so far. But yeah, that's sexual assault. And if you're one of those guys, I fucking hope no one listens to this podcast, or if you are someone who listens to this podcast and you're one of those people who are online saying that you have the right to spread your seed and that this is like a cool thing to do, you're a fucking piece of shit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Period. Not okay, not cool.
Yeah, I think the paper that I read was really about like how we're gonna treat this. It's just only really been recently given a term, stealthing, and the lines between consent, they're really discussed at length in this paper, which maybe we can share on our Facebook page. But I think it is unfortunately it's not a tricky one when we talk about it. But in terms of like, I think writing legislation and stuff like that takes a long time. It's like, how exactly do you describe something in such a way? I think what they're saying in the paper is like, you can draw the line because penis is withdrawn, the condom's removed, and then reentry. So it's two separate acts. Mm. And consent to sex with a condom is different than sex consent, knowing, like, you're aware of the risks if you consent to sex without a condom. So those are two different, the risks are very different. When I did a quick reading on this and reading about what the supporters of stealthing are, and some of them are women,
women are supporting stealthing?
Yeah, there's
what
like
argument is what's that argument
that a man has a right to spread his seed?
Oh, but, shut the fuck up.
There's a barebacking brotherhood, ugh, I think is the hashtag for it, and websites, I guess, that I haven't been able to find, but forums that I guess give tips to men on how to do it stealthily. And it's obviously also an issue in the same sex community, so the same argument is still made on those forums, according to this paper, even though pregnancy is impossible. It seems pretty messed up, and generally the reasons for doing it are it feels better, there is the thrill of doing something that's degrading, and that it just some men have a hard time keeping an erection with a condom on.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and none of those things are just cause to assault someone.
Yeah, especially when your solution is to apologize and rush out and buy Plan B. I don't know if anybody here hasn't taken Plan B. It fucks you up. It's not like, oh, the morning after pill, you just pop it in and it's all good. It really messes with your biology for a while.
Well, in this case, okay, so coming to Jenny's situation, Let's just assume here that her partner is not one of those people who's like trolling Reddit and commenting on forums saying that this is super cool and super okay to like stealth.
Yeah.
Maybe let's assume that he doesn't even know that stealthing is a term.
Right.
Because I'll tell you right now, I didn't even know that that was a thing until we read this email.
Yeah.
So let's assume that he's that kind of person. And he was very embarrassed that he couldn't get his dick hard. And so he decides, well, I know that in the past I've been able to be hard and stay hard when I remove a condom. Look, I'll tell you right now, I've had that situation in my life where I've been wearing a condom and I go, this condom where I'm at right now is making it next to impossible for me to get erect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's assume he's in that situation and he decides without her consent to take off his condom and have sex with her. That was wrong. Mm-hmm. Period. That was wrong. Now, Ginny's still with this guy 9 months later. I'm hoping, I would hope that Ginny is someone who is with someone who's really great and treats her awesome, treats her right. Let's assume that that's the case. They're together for 9 months. Mm-hmm. Let's hope that their relationship is really solid and really wonderful. Ginny is wondering how to bring this up to her partner.
Yeah.
I think you just got to bring it up. But here's the thing that I want to say to Ginny, and I don't know how you feel about this, Bridie, but the worry that you don't want him to feel guilty and feel bad about what he did, I think you got to let that go.
Yeah.
I think you just have to bring this up, and sure, bring it up in the lightest, most like open communication based way with like lots of understanding and love behind it. But if he feels guilty and shitty about it, let him fucking be a baby and feel as guilty as he needs to feel. Don't let that be the thing that makes you not want to bring it up. Like, I think you just gotta, I think this is a fucking hard truth that a pill that he has to swallow. Mm-hmm. And you got to bring it up and be like, look, can we agree that what happened was super fucked up? And here's why. Mm-hmm. Because it's akin to rape. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that. That was my first impulse, based on what I read, that you're about your concern about him feeling guilty and hurt, considering the few rounds of emotions you went through on dealing with that immediately after and suppressing those feelings, and then them coming up again when you found this paper. I think it's okay for him to feel bad about that, and being in love with someone and loving someone doesn't mean that you can't be, you have to, you know, tiptoe around their emotions and make sure that they never feel anything bad. And it'll be really important for both of you to be able to have a difficult conversation and then hopefully be able to put it behind you emotionally, because otherwise those things, they come back, they surface again. If you hold on to them, if you don't talk them through, if you don't work through them, they surface again in some other way. Something will trigger it and you'll feel, you know, you'll feel violated by something, and it'll come back with a force that is not healthy or appropriate for whatever the next context is.
And if your fear is that he's going to make it about himself in that sort of guilty, like wallowing in his own filth kind of thing, then call him out on that and be like, this fucking isn't about you. Mm-hmm. It's about you and that you were involved, but this isn't like, I'm the one who was violated here.
Yeah.
So this is why I'm bringing this up. You know, don't let him make it about himself.
Yeah, one of the things in the paper was like one of the testimonials from someone who had experienced this, and she was just saying like the feeling that she had was I was not important enough to be considered. Like, this person just didn't care about the fact that I could get an STI or I could get knocked up. It wasn't their problem, and that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of thing you want to nip in the bud early on in a relationship, if you feel like that could be even just a recurrent behavior in a much more subtle way. And so kind of addressing that thing off the top, I think, is good. Clear the air. Mm-hmm. For sure. Maybe share some of this literature with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because...
Maybe don't share this podcast with him.
Yeah.
I was feeling a little heated.
I was really angry. I think that's when I said I was cranky. Mm-hmm. It was because I knew we were going to talk about this.
But, you know, I don't want, I, people fuck up, right?
Yeah.
And he might not have done that with the, he might have done that to Ginny without, like, really without considering the ramifications. Yeah. And really without, like, you know, when you get like fuck drunk and you're in a state, like, I'm, you know, if he wasn't doing it with malicious intent, not to excuse it, but just, you know, I would hate to, like,
yeah, we don't want to pin him as a bad guy.
No. And I would hate for you to, like, break, you know, for you guys to lose a relationship that means a lot to the two of you over something like this. So, be, you know, be compassionate, be loving, but also be firm and be and
misogyny and toxic masculinity are big terms floating around in my world lately, like just hearing people talk about that more and more. And this is like an opportunity for if there is any of that going on, then for someone, for this guy, your boyfriend, to like rise above that and be like, gives them the opportunity to be like, you're right, I was wrong. Yeah. And that is healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well,
okay.
Do you want to, oh man, that was fucking heavy. Let's get into our conversation with Dr. Fisher, because it's one of those, like, it's fascinating and it's very light, but also kind of dark as well.
I know. And you're going to start to see these things that she talks about everywhere.
Yeah.
And
I feel like I'm dying to know what her thoughts are on stealthing.
Yeah.
And what, you know, what that means for, you know, like why the fuck, why people would do that. But anyway, we hope you enjoy this week's episode. Dr. Fisher is a really, really special guest. I hope we can have her on again someday.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And let us know your thoughts. You can hit us up on social media, and you can email us if you ever have a brain boner or you have thoughts on any episode, that's Sick Boy. You can send it to info@sickboypodcast.com, and then I'll
same head office.
I'll send it over to Bridie.
All right.
Termionpodcast@gmail.com. There we go.
You got it.
Cool. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you on the other side.
Bye-bye.
Marianne Fisher, correct?
Are you a doctor? Dr. Fisher?
I am a Dr. Fisher.
Holy shit, we got a doctor in the studio. See, what I love about this I was kind of talking to you about this earlier before we started recording, but, you know, most of the people we talk to on the podcast are just everyday people kind of going through their lives. Some of them like to be peed on. Some of them like to, you know, be fisted. And we just talk to them about that experience or whatever. And every once in a while, and with Sick Boy too, every once in a while, we get to sit down with someone who maybe they like to be peed on. I don't know. Maybe they like to be fisted. But not only that, they really, really know what they're talking about. An expert in their field. And because I am a self-proclaimed idiot, I feel like these are one of my favorite conversations to have, because they're always learning experiences no matter who you're talking to. But there's something just a little more rich when we get to talk to someone.
Particularly when we just got some fan mail that was like, can you please start fact checking your...
That was really funny. Yeah. We can go into that later.
And we got your contact information from a listener who is a student of yours. I can't remember their name off the top of my head, and I don't know if they'd want that disclosed anyway.
Yes, all right.
But they were really persistent or insistent that we have you come in here and
well, I'm
chat.
Happy to be here.
So, Marianne, what is it? What brings you in here? What is it that you...
What are you a doctor of?
Yeah.
Ah, what am I a doctor of? Well, so my PhD is experimental psychology. And what I'm specifically known for is evolutionary psychology. So that would be blending, say, not just biology and psychology, but really looking at natural and sexual selection in relation to humans. Ooh. So I'll give you an example, okay? Because I might have gone like way over already.
I am so excited.
But so I look at humans as essentially any other animal or living organism. And I look at the brain, for example, as just another organ of the body. So when I talk about, say, feelings or why you like to eat certain foods, maybe, or your reactions to jealousy or how you compete for mates, I look at that as a set of adaptations, biological adaptations, that have occurred over somewhere between 2 million years and 10,000 years ago. And I take into account the environment. So I take into account things like what sort of family did you have and all that great stuff. And then I take into account what the physical environment might have been like that led you to have that biology as well.
Mm.
So it's really multifaceted. It's crazy rich. But that's really my background. And then my specialty, which is probably why I'm sitting on your couch, is I study primarily how women compete for mates. And I look at mostly heterosexual women right now. And I look at all the nasty things they might do to get sort of one up on each other.
So you said heterosexual. And so, because that was one of my things when I wanted to ask you about when you said, when I read that in your bio, was like, does this include studies on like trans women as well as, you know?
I wish it did.
Okay.
I really, really wish it did. We've done a few studies and we've had problems with publications so far. The science community is just not quite there yet. So we've done studies looking at self-reported non-heterosexual women. So that's really a wide umbrella, yeah. Obviously. Mm. And we've looked also at straight women, self-reported straight women, who engage in non-heterosexual behaviors as well. So that's also a huge community.
Is that like experimental stuff? Is that what they mean by that?
Well, we actually call it sexual fluidity, but not in the Lisa Diamond sense. So we consider it, we don't consider the spectrum to be sort of, you know, straight and gay either end and then, you know, bi somewhere in the middle. That's really, it's too binary for us. Mm-hmm. And so some of the work that I've done with one of my PhD students, we were looking at the mostly or primarily heterosexual, but who actually engage in really intense lesbian relationships.
Okay.
So it's not really experimental. It's a bit deeper than that, but yeah, but that would fall into it. But yeah, we've had all sorts of obstacles. And one of the other issues is sample size. So when we do studies in psychology, we often need like, I don't know, say 200 people, right? And when we're doing quick and easy studies around Halifax, it's really hard to find 200 women who wouldn't classify themselves as primarily heterosexual who are available to do these studies.
Mm. So it's just an easier sample to take from.
It is.
Right.
Especially when you're trying to control for other demographic variables. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, it's coming.
For the sake of what we're talking about today, mm-hmm. I guess it's safe to say that mostly what we're talking about is what you've learned through the study of heterosexual
Absolutely.
Females. Yep. Okay. This might be too broad of a question, and just like the nerd mind of me is really curious to know, but like what might be some of the things that, oh man, and here comes my dumbness as well. I don't know how to even word this question because I'm not nearly as smart as anybody else in this room.
But text me and I'll help you.
What is some of the like behavioral, some of the behaviors, I guess, sexually that have been, how do I even word this?
Okay.
Over time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's not that broad. I think what you're going to ask is you're actually specific to mm-hmm. what your studies is. I think your question is like, what are behaviors that females engage in that are mating or?
Well, yeah. Or even more general mm-hmm. than that, just like sexual behaviors that have been looked at and attributed to our evolutionary
Gotcha.
Progress that okay. people might not even realize,
like consistently okay. over time.
Yeah, maybe? Yeah, okay. Like things that you know as a fact, as someone who studies evolutionary behavior.
Gotcha. I think I get what you're saying. So,
if your answer is not what I'm looking for, I'll definitely tell you.
That's a good thing. Okay, so one of the main, I guess, key points of evolutionary psychology is that women and men really differ in how many children they can produce, right?
Okay.
So let's just go back to that for
of
a
course.
Second. And what that means in the long run is that, you know, women are investing a lot in their children. They also invest a lot even at a biological level. So their eggs are a lot larger than men's sperm and all that kind of stuff. And then they get pregnant, lactate, take care of young babies, and so on and so on. So because of women's much larger investment, the theory is that they have to be really picky about the men that they're going to date or have sex with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So men, on the other hand, don't have that same sort of, we call it a burden, like without value judgment attached to it, but it's an energetic burden, okay? So because men don't have that issue, their issue is about sexual access. So when we talk about it, we used to talk about it as a quantity versus quality issue. So women can easily find a guy to hook up with, but they can't necessarily find a quality guy to hook up with, right? Mm. So And the reverse of that is that men try to have access. So they're looking for, sometimes they're looking for quality, especially long-term stuff. But if they just want to hook up, they're not necessarily too picky. And a lot of social psychology literature shows that that's the case. So going forward to what you were saying then, say we're going downtown and we're looking around the club, what sort of things might we see, right? Like, let's just start with that part. Mm-hmm. So we would see women often engaging in behaviors with each other, first of all. So they might be trying to figure out who the other woman's interested in so they can, you know, not play, make a play for that guy, unless he's really desirable, in which case she might tell her friend, who's also interested in the guy, hey, no, you don't want him. He's got an STI. I just heard it on the street. He's a total player. Like, don't touch him. When she goes to the bathroom, she goes up to the guy and makes a play for him. Okay, right. So that sort of stuff. Men, on the other hand, might do things like they might advertise their resources, because women are attracted to money for various reasons. So they might wear a fake Rolex when they go out. We've seen that in our data. They might say all sorts of great things.
I use that one all the time. Guys, it works like a charm.
But it's really, and then it also comes down to things like, how long does it take before, you know, sexual access is granted, which, you know, huge differences. You're just laughing.
No, you know what? I'm laughing because you said that, and it reminded me of this time. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm about to say this. This time that I went out to the Pacifico here in Halifax, it's like a nightclub, don't worry about that. I was with someone who was rooting through we were up the ATM. We had to get some money to go to the bar and buy some drinks. Mm-hmm. I'm like 19 at this time. Mm-hmm. And I'm with a gentleman who is a little bit older than me, and he's rooting through all of the slips, the receipts that are given back from the ATM that are left on the top of the ATM. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. here's how much money you have left in your account. Yeah. And people just look at it and they go, well, I don't fucking need this receipt. And they just put it on the top of the machine.
Yeah.
Well, he's rooting through them all. And I'm going, what are you doing? And he's going, I'm trying to find the one that has the highest balance.
Oh my God.
The highest balance within the account, so that when I give a girl my number, I'm going to write it on the back of this thing. And when they flip it over, they're going to go, holy shit, this guy's got X amount of money in his account.
Brilliant.
And I remember being at 19, I was going, God damn. That was a fucking brilliant idea.
That's some game right there.
Oh my God.
So yeah, you're right. Like,
I might use that in my research.
I'll
give you credit for it.
Yeah. Fuck a Rolex. Just show the money.
That's
right
easy.
Where it is.
Yeah, I like that.
Sneaky. It's a sneaky little move, you know? Oh, wow. Can't believe that. You just like uprooted that silly memory. So in terms of, okay, and this might be completely off topic. And if it is, mm-hmm. you know, don't let me derail it. But I once heard that there were, and does this kind of dive into some of the stuff that you have researched, or is this a little in a bit of a different department? But mm-hmm. This notion or this concept that how anorexia mm-hmm. has basically like an evolutionary behavioral thing mm-hmm. that came into play based on particularly women trying to avoid like finding a partner or something like that.
I haven't heard that explanation. So a really good friend of mine, Catherine Salmon, has published a bunch of papers with some of their colleagues, and she's looked at anorexia as a losing strategy, or as a way that women might compete with each other to sort of win the best guy out there. But what happens is that, so women are pressuring each other, right, mm-hmm. to look different, to look better, and all this other stuff. But what happens is that when you get to a certain body fat point, not only are you anorexic, but you lose any fertility, right? So
right.
you've totally, as soon as your fertility is gone, from an evolutionary point of view, you've just lost the competition.
Right.
And so it's basically like a runaway phenomenon. So it's just gotten out of control to the point where that's happened. So that's as much as I know about that argument, but there's mm-hmm. some fantastic work coming out of her stuff right now.
I find the whole like evolutionary biology and how it affects behavior. That's I just find
crazy.
That stuff so interesting and so yeah. crazy. And I know that in some ways it's very kind of it can be a bit of a touchy subject, and mm-hmm. some people have a hard time wrapping their head around it. And I'm sure you come up against that kind of stuff.
I get
especially
hate mail.
Yeah, of course.
What do you mean?
And I'm sure there's going to be people who listen to this podcast today and go, this is fucking bullshit.
What is controversial about evolutionary biology?
So when applied to humans, that seems to be the lightning rod, right?
Okay.
Because we're saying that humans have, first of all, an evolutionary past, which goes against some other accounts of the world, right? And then we're also saying that humans haven't been able to free themselves of their biological past. So you're running into the philosophy of free will and all those sorts of things as well. But what I find... And this is the thing I have going on at St. Mary's. So I'm teaching this as a first-year course, which, as far as I know, happens nowhere else in the world. Everywhere else in the world, it's an upper-year course, okay? So I have brand new, like, 18-year-olds walking in the classroom to take this course they know nothing about. And I feel like they're walking with all these preconceptions about what evolution is and is not. So I start the course by saying what it's not, right? So I talk about all the criticisms, like how we talk about sexism and rape is an evolved mechanism and all these other things that they may have heard about in the media or, mm-hmm. you know, their friends and family might say as arguments. And I go through one by one about how these criticisms either aren't legit, it's just a misunderstanding of the field, or how they are actually important criticisms, especially because they bring up these holes in our theory or how they lead to misinterpretations by the general public. So I've yet to find, at a personal level, any reason to stop studying it. But there is a lot of hate mail. And then I take also, I'm a feminist evolutionary psychologist now, right? So I do a lot of stuff about trying to look at women as active agents in human evolutionary history. Mm-hmm. So I look at just all sorts of random different things at this point, but I'm beginning to get somewhere. But because I'm using feminist theory and attaching it to biology, I get a whole lot of hate mail from that camp, too.
Yeah,
so
right.
I've just annoyed a lot of people at this point, yeah. I feel like. But
so where did, like, feminist theory begin?
For me, as coming in?
Yeah, I guess mm-hmm. so. And, like, in human evolution.
Gotcha. So the field, this is a big question, so I'm just going to break it into a couple different parts, okay?
Yeah.
So interrupt as you want. But so the field didn't really pick up into the 80s. There was a famous book published by Wilson called Sociobiology in the 70s. Last chapter was about humans and social behavior as having an evolutionary past. So that was the beginning of the field. So that's not that long ago, right? And even though there was a women's movement that was active during that time, it wasn't touching into that field at all. Like, it was sort of isolated. Move into the 80s, you have a lot of men as key players. You have women as graduate students, still not a lot of women's influence. So the field, I think, by necessity, really began to look at men as having this very active role. And Darwin's work is inherently quite sexist as well.
Right.
So along comes, you know, these new generations like Sarah Hurdy in the 80s, 90s, and saying, no, like, women play a very active role in human evolution. You just haven't looked for it.
Right.
You know, like, look at the way mothers interact with their children, you know, and look at the ways that women interact with each other. They don't have a status hierarchy. They don't, you know, engage in warfare in the same way, but they do a lot of other stuff. It's really important. So there was always this sort of feminist element, but it just wasn't brought to light, I guess. And then the way I got into it was I actually avoided the feminist word. Like, I was being trained by someone who was a pure experimentalist saying, there's no bias in science. You have to be on the fringes of that idea. You can't dive into it. And I kept getting told by my field I was a feminist. Well, you study women. I also studied men, but you study women, therefore you're a feminist. I was like, what? Say what? Like, how does that make me a feminist?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like saying because you study cats, you're an expert in felines all the time. Like, it doesn't, you know. So anyway, it just got to be the point where it was ridiculous. And so I honestly feel like I threw my hands up in the air one day and went, fine, I'm a feminist.
Deal with
Get
it.
Get on with it.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
And so that changed everything. Because all of a sudden, well, now you're a self-proclaimed feminist.
Wow.
You have to stand up for the field. So I've enjoyed it. I've definitely had a lot of really different conversations that way. But
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I would love to dive back into the intrasexual competition,
sure.
Female intrasexual competition.
Yeah.
Is that so? That is basically the we were kind of talking about earlier, the things that females do to to root out and find the like perfect mate? Is that
what? Yeah, it's also just how they interact with each other to keep the mates they have, or what sort of things they might want to do to gain access to the mate they want. So it's broad, but I can give you some examples if you want.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Okay, so when we think about competition, for mating, okay, so I'm going to focus on mating because there's competition for all sorts of different things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so mating competition, there's really four strategies that both men and women do. So the first is self-promote, which is where you're going out to the nightclub, so you look as good as you can. You try to act nice to everyone. You flash money around if you're a guy.
Or a slip, a receipt.
Or a slip.
Don't forget, guys.
But you try to make yourself look as great as possible. But the thing is, you don't know who you're up against. Like, mm-hmm. when you walk into that club, that's when you see all those rivals, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing with self-promotion. And you might say, oh, well, I just want to look good because it makes me feel better. Well, that's nice, and that might be true, but it also does have this advantage of putting you on top of competition.
Okay? I wonder if in making you feel better mm-hmm. is actually also just the sort of natural, like,
advantage.
You know, yeah, you know, you're putting yourself up and like you're putting yourself. You're trying to.
You look good. You feel good. You
yeah, but you're trying to take advantage, and so it's just naturally, inherently going to make you feel better. You know,
it could be.
Yeah,
you might inflate your mate value, right? Mm-hmm. So we talk about how everyone out there in the world is a magic number or two above their head. Right. So what you are worth at that moment in that context as a mate,
like 0 to 10.
I could consider it 1 to 7, but yeah, 0 to 10. Sure.
Is there a scientific reason behind the 1 to 7?
It's because of the whole theory behind scale development. Anyway, it's just...
It's a whole other it's nerdy head, concept. Right.
0 to 10 would work too.
Okay.
And then I'm arguing now that there's actually more than one number because there's more than one context in which you might want to date someone. So that's where I'm going with my work. But,
okay.
But if you feel good, you might think your number is a little bit higher. So you might make a play for someone who's a little bit higher than you normally would.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I see that kind of fitting in. But
which could be to your advantage.
Oh, big time.
Right? Like the whole confidence thing plays a big role.
As someone who was once a teenage girl and a girl in their 20s, the value of like feeling good, like putting your time in and feeling good when you go out is... Like, I just think about how my insecurities as a woman in my 20s and, like, the effort that sometimes I'd be like, I'm wearing sweatpants and a hoodie because I don't care.
And I'm going to be a 7 when I do it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a mind game.
But it's also, like, in a way, you're drawing attention to the fact that you're so confident,
mm-hmm. yeah.
right? That could be a big turn on, too, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So... Yeah, there is a lot of stuff to unfold there. It's crazy.
Man.
And that's the most effective strategy, and that's the most well-used strategy, too.
Is to look good.
Yeah, feel good, to advertise your personal,
right.
you know, personality, whatever. And sometimes, too, it's actually trying to establish commonality. So you might say, hey, what are you into as a potential mate? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I'm into that, too. And even if it's a lie, because it's a way to make yourself look more intelligent.
Or, mm-hmm.
So that's one.
I've used that one before, for sure I've used
the
that.
The list of things that Jeremy is really into.
I love this. I can't wait to hear the one I haven't used so that I can be like, add that to the docket. What's next?
I'm pretty sure you've used all of them. So there's competitor derogation.
I'm sorry. Say that. What did you just call me?
Competitor derogation.
Derogation.
I read about this on the internet today.
Okay.
So derogation is just trying to put someone down, right? So in our context, it would be things like, I'll give you a good example. I call this the jellyfish sting. So imagine you're sitting at a table with your potential rival and the guy you're interested in, right? And you say, hey, by the way, sir, you look amazing. No one would ever guess you have gonorrhea right now. Right? And it's like zing because it's a compliment, but, you know.
It's a backhand.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's an indirect derogation. But you might do things like spread rumors about each other.
Mm-hmm.
You might actually bully her, or if it's a dude, you know, bully him. You can use physical aggression, although women tend not to use that too much. So it's ways of making the rival seem inferior relative to you,
mm-hmm.
which means you have to know who they are. So it's different. Like when you're going to the club, then you're looking around at who's competing for the same people you are, and you're targeting them for the competition.
Which makes it so much more nasty.
Oh, yeah.
Because you got to know them.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Right? Yeah.
Is that...
So Jerry Springer. I love it.
And a big thing that comes up a lot on our podcast, which I feel like falls under that, is like slut shaming.
Oh, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, and it'll come up actually again, I think, because there's two more strategies. So one is mate manipulation. So this is where you have the potential target in mind and you've identified who you're both interested in. So the rival's interested in also. And you start to go, okay, I might be just a little bit ahead in this competition. So I'm going to now take the target out of the way. So for example, you might try to start mate guarding. So you're tying up the mate so he's got no free time to spend with anyone else. Or you're constantly texting him to make sure that he's always around, he's available, he's not with her. It's vast, the stuff you do.
The clingy technique. Getting clingy.
But it's very effective. That's right. The funny thing. Like, it's really, it also shows you care, mm-hmm. right? So it has that weird little, you know, positive part of it too. Mm-hmm. But it's a way of you could also lie to the mate. You could also say, oh yeah, you know, oh, she's really ugly. She's got terribly fat ankles, which is derogation, but it's also manipulating the mate into thinking something differently.
Right.
Right. And I've done a lot of research sort of on that part and the derogation part.
Would mate manipulation also be like, yeah, I have this guy that's texting me all the time and I can't get him off my back. Anyway, you were saying, like,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
That kind of like...
I have lots of other options available to me.
Exactly.
And you're okay. Lucky you have me, so you should want to really have me.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the last one is competitor manipulation. And this one I find the most interesting in some ways, but this is where you might say to your rival, oh yeah, you don't want to be involved with him at all because he's got an STI. So you actually slam the mate to get her to not be interested in him, and then you make the play. Or it might be telling her all sorts of things about herself that she could confirm. So for example, you really have no friends, you know, everyone's just really using you because you have some money and you have no way in heck of getting that guy. So don't even try.
Mm.
So you make her feel really cruddy about herself so that you would win the competition. So there's some overlap in how they are.
Yeah.
But it's just, and this all came up from a study where I had people come into the lab one at a time, gave him a sheet of paper and just said, how do you compete for dates?
Mm.
And it was just like, oh my God, some of the stories, I have to tell you one more. This is actually my favorite one.
Yes.
So a lot of the time when women and men, but mostly women, when they talk about competing, they're competing with their friends, especially women in their 20s, yeah. University students. And you have to remember that we often choose friends who are about the same mate value as us. Okay. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. So if you look around at your friends, even if one's not as attractive as the next friend, they probably have some other redeeming quality that would pick up their mate value.
I see.
So we tend to be about the same value as our friends.
Is there something to be said about people who hang out with people that are much higher in the...
Lower?
Yes. Yes, okay. So, okay.
Because I'm thinking about those two guys up there, Brian and Taylor, and I'm going, they're like super fucking handsome, and I'm just sticking with them only because I know that it probably boosts my attractiveness just a little bit.
Right.
Anyway, continue.
Oh yeah. Well, it does make sense. So if we actually call it the cheerleader or halo effect in one case. So if you're, especially if you're a woman and you surround yourself with other really beautiful women, like a little bit higher than you, it actually boosts your perceived attractiveness.
Whoa.
Yeah. But then there's also the contrast effect, which is where if you're surrounded by quite unattractive people and you're attractive, it actually makes your attractiveness pop even more.
Right.
So, yeah, there's something there. We're doing a study with Tinder and we've looked at that, like who you post pictures with.
Uh-huh.
And we haven't quite finished it. So that was something we're looking at in the background.
Yeah. Must be a brand new fascinating.
Oh, we have such fun in the lab. Like, no, we really
kidding.
Do. It's great stuff. It's great stuff.
We were coming back though. We were at, you were saying, I kind of derailed it, but...
Oh, my favorite story.
Yes
about the friends. Oh my God, it's such a great story. But I find it great. So I had a woman who was doing the survey, and these are university students. Okay, this is a while ago now. And she came back to me and she said, are you sure that no one's going to read these other than you?
Uh-oh.
And I said, absolutely. Like, this is purely anonymous because you don't put your information here. I won't be looking at your answers for a good month. Like, you know, and also I'll be the only one reading them. And so she wrote out this really elaborate story about how her best friend and her were going clubbing. And first of all, her friend, when they were picking out their outfits, they went shopping together. And her friend picked out something that made her look fat, okay? Really unattractive. And she asked her friend, how do I look? And her friend, my participant, was like, you look amazing. Fabulous. Yeah. It's so amazing. You should buy it. So first of all, she set up her friend to look terrible. And then they go out. They're at the bar. And her friend's got toilet paper stuck to her shoe, okay? You know, it's a bit of a faux pas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the friend goes to leave the bathroom, and my participant says nothing. Nothing. And this is her best friend.
Sees it. Says nothing. You know?
Nothing. Says mm-hmm. nothing. And I was like, oh my God. Like, this is really, yeah. That's when I got so sucked in by the topic.
Yeah.
I was like, if women are treating their friends like this, what are they doing to the women they don't like? You know, like.
And so to come wow. back to the, you know, the way that men and women sort of their worldview and how they're trying to find mates, women are looking for the alpha male, like the, like, or not the alpha male, but like the sort of perfect mate mm-hmm. to reproduce
them.
For them.
Yeah.
Which it can be different from, you know, person to person.
Absolutely.
Whereas the male typically is like, I'm just looking to spread my seed. Mm-hmm. It is, as long as the door is open.
Yeah. To some extent.
Like, to some extent.
There's some research that shows that, when men are looking at someone for a long-term marriage prospect, they do judge what she's wearing, for example. Mm. So whereas they would like the more revealing clothes and a short-term one-night thing, mm-hmm. They're not going to bring that woman home to mom if she's right. wearing that sort of stuff. And that's something that the literature really clearly shows, is that when you go into a situation, most people probably don't go, okay, tonight I'm looking just for a hookup, and even if they're fantastic, I'm never going to be with them for more than a week. Mm. And most people don't make that decision, right? Mm-hmm. They think, oh yeah, I'm just in the mood for some fun, right? But they also, like, people don't discount that if they find the one that they're just going to ignore and keep on shopping. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we use these different variables, I think, as a way of sort of marking what sort of potential that relationship has, which is why when I hear what, like, you know, I have all sorts of friends who met their significant other in a bar, and I'm like, interesting, what were they wearing? Like, that's what I want to know. Like, what were they doing? And it's usually, well, they were just dressed normally, and they were just themselves. Like, mm-hmm. you know, they made me laugh, especially for men, like making women laugh. Or they bought me a drink, or we just started talking and we couldn't stop talking. Like, oh dear, I've stumbled on something.
I'm like, I'm pretty sure we're married because you made me laugh.
That's the only reason. Yeah. So in the differences in how men and women view the world, mm-hmm. Is what you're saying, like this intersexual, female intersexual competition, mm-hmm. is it much more intense for women than it is for men generally, like in terms of how we compete?
Okay, so the sexes compete very differently in many ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I got into this is because all the literature addressed males competition. So basically, like, men duking it out behind the bar in, you know, fighting with each other physically. And the idea was that they're fighting over a woman, and the woman would just take the winner, passively right. just take the winner.
It's like two gorillas really? Out in the wild. Yeah. One's like, hey, I won. Now yeah. I get the harem.
And the competition literature. Harem? No. The harem.
Is harem women too? Or just men?
It's usually gorillas.
Female or male gorillas?
it was just, and the competition literature, the psychology competition literature, was mostly about men or about some, you know, mixed sex stuff. But there was nothing really on women and what women or girls were doing, right? And so when you look at the aggression literature, because I know I'm doing all the dots now, right? But the aggression literature was mostly focused on this idea that women were indirect. So, you know, they spread rumors or they ostracize, so they kick, you know, women over their social group or whatever. Whereas men tend to be much more direct and may or may not be as verbal as women. The literature is sort of split mm-hmm. on that one. And this happens all the way from childhood onward, right?
Yeah.
So when I was looking at all this and then looking at competition from, you know, for a mating point of view, it was, there's so much written about men competing and women just sort of sucking up the loser, to put it badly. But it was just, you know, that's not the way it works. Like, women don't just stand by and go, oh, well, I guess that's who I'm going to be with now. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like, that's, any Hollywood movie would show you that's not usually the way it works anyway. So that's where the field was at. And the field's sort of there still, at least for men. So a lot of the male literature still talks about how, you know, men are competing using physical means, or they flash their money, or they bully each other, or they intimidate each other. They use their physical size, stuff like that. Where it's getting interesting, and I might be going too far off now, where it's getting interesting, though, is you look at countries with a biased sex ratio. So you look at countries where the number of women versus the number of men is totally changed. So say China, right? Mm-hmm. And you're seeing now, you know, the implications of the one-child policy coming through. So you've got men in their 30s, a lot of men in their 30s, not having a chance to find a mate, right? Because there's so few women relative to the number of men. So all of a sudden, what men are doing to attract a mate is changing. So you see a lot more salons devoted to improving men's physical appearance, grooming men. You see a lot more courses around training men about social skills. It's really shifting.
Wow.
And that's what I find fascinating. And there's so little information on it.
Which totally links back to the idea that it's adaptation.
Yeah,
it's evolutionary.
Absolutely.
If your environment is changing, mm-hmm. then you innately you're going to change the way that you come at it. You're gonna change up your game plan.
Yeah.
I fucking love science, even though I don't know it.
I know. I'm just like trying to picture like the examples of girls in the club not telling their best friends about toilet paper attached to their foot like 2,000 years ago, like just trying to imagine what the scenarios are.
So one thing you have to keep in mind, just if you're picturing that scenario, right, is that our social group would be small. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a lot of the literature, the anthropology literature, suggests that our social group may be 150 people, right? Yeah. So, you know, when we gossiped about someone, I love talking about gossip. When we gossip about someone, it would actually be someone we knew, right? And that by getting that information about them, we would actually go, oh, we shouldn't loan them resources, or we shouldn't sleep with them, right? Whereas today we hear gossip, and it's like, oh, that's cool, you know?
Yeah, so
it's
right.
a different level. But yeah, no toilet paper, but maybe you wouldn't tell your best friend there that she's got poop running down the back of her leg.
Yeah
right.
There you go. I don't know.
I don't know if I'd tell them just because I'd be embarrassed to bring it up. Is there something to be said for females or males that are infertile or mm-hmm. sterile? Like, and does the behavior change if they can't even make a baby?
Yeah, we've done a little bit of research on that, and we did it from a jealousy point of view. So it's not exactly about competition.
Super interesting. I totally cut you off.
That's
there.
Okay,
I'm so sorry,
okay.
but continue, because I think I just assumed where you were going with that. Fuck.
Jeremy, write it down. Write it down. That's why I have a pencil and paper.
We can go into that for a minute if you want.
Yeah,
okay,
I'd love to.
All right, dive into that one for a second. So one of the hot spots within evolutionary social psychology is about jealousy and infidelity, right? And the classic study is something along the lines of, imagine you're in a committed relationship and you find out that your partner has had sex once and only once with someone, and there was no emotional involvement. How upset or distressed would you be? Versus you're in the same relationship and you find out your partner's had an emotional relationship but would not have sex. Like, how upset would you be? So mm-hmm. an emotionally involved relationship. And you can vary this according to time scales and all sorts of things. And cross-culturally, using all sorts of different measures, about two-thirds of women say they'd be more upset about the emotional condition. Two-thirds of men say the sexual condition. So we took that. We've used it in different ways. But one of the things we did was look at whether or not the person's infertile as the third party and how jealousy and distress reacts with that. Because the idea is that if you're engaged in a sexual relationship with someone and they're fertile, then maybe you're getting upset because there could be a kid coming out of that relationship. Mm. Versus if they're infertile, that changes it. Or if you're infertile, it changes it, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's crazy. And so the infertility causes huge effects. So as soon as you find out that someone's infertile, the sexual being upset about the sexual relationship goes down, and the emotional stuff picks up, which is really interesting. So
now how do you feel about that? Hearing that, because I'm infertile,
okay.
I'm sterile, mm-hmm. and when we started opening things up in our marriage, do you think that played a role in? I mean, huge question to ask you, Bridie, but like, do you feel like the fact that I can't make a baby with anybody else changed the way that you felt about jealousy and the idea of me sleeping with somebody else?
I mean, when it came to contraception, for sure, but not jealousy. I know. I don't think I marked that.
Right.
I don't think that came into play.
Man, that's so fascinating.
Oh, did it really have an impact for you?
Well, I'll tell you right now, the thought of you sleeping with someone who's fertile and them giving you a baby, like impregnating you, that tears
giving
me apart.
To me, like, yeah, it's something I want.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Presenting you with a perfect baby. That guts me, right? Wow. Like, I can't, but the idea of you sleeping with somebody,
wow.
It's all good. All good. But the thought of you getting pregnant, I'm like, oh, Nelly,
that's a
bridge.
Yeah,
and that's
a different one.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. Super interesting. One thing that I would love to ask you about all the work that you're doing. So I know as a scientist, you gather data, you look at the data and you say, this is what I've learned. And this is how we see the world. And here's my study or here's my findings and try to challenge it. And if you can't, great, I win.
Right. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. But out of all the work that you are doing, like the work that you are essentially devoting your life to, from the findings that you've come across, what would you like to, what do you feel like would be the end goal or the takeaway from that discovery or those discoveries?
That's a really big question. I think, so I've been looking at women in competition now for 20 years this month. Okay. So that's a sizable portion of my life, obviously. And I've done a lot of studies on everything from pornography to the Muppets to, Harlequin romance novels. Like, it's been a very vast career in that time. And the one thing that I think would be a takeaway message from all of that is there's a strength to understanding the biological part. And I'm not wording that well, but everything I know about science means that life is going to find a way to happen. And that might be you know, a situation of coevolution where you have two parasites battling it out to take over an organism. Or it might be two women battling it out for the best guy. Like, people are smart. Like, even someone that doesn't look all that intelligent, there can be a big old scheme behind what they're doing, right? And they may not be consciously aware of why they're doing it, but it's brilliant. You know, like, it's just one of those things that I find mind-blowing all the time. Over and over again, is how we do these things that we don't necessarily understand why we're doing them, and they work. You know, like, it's just, I'm absolutely blown away by how life will find a way and how we are constantly as a species adapting to things. It's just incredible. It really is.
As someone who studies that, do you think that, how much of an effect do you think that that's had on the way that you go about your day?
It's huge. I have to admit, it's huge. So being someone that studies competition and aggression and, let's say, some of the more nasty stuff that people do to each other, it's made, like, when I walk into a room, I like to watch people. I always have. That's why I'm a psychologist, right? But when I walk into a room and I see people interacting, it gives me this insight that's different, I think. But it also, I think when I see kindness, it highlights it so much more. Genuine kindness, not kindness because it's expected, not kindness because it's a play, but genuine self-sacrificing kindness. Or, you know, when you're trying to help someone out at a workplace, say, for no particular reason other than it just feels good to you, you won't gain a reputation status out of it. You're not going to gain, like, a tit for tat, reciprocal altruism, we call it, but like a you know, a favor you can call in. When you're doing it just because it feels good and you want to, that's the stuff I've noticed the most. So in my daily life, when I see people letting others in on the road, this is a good example, driving here. When I see people letting other people in on the road with the knowledge that they're probably never going to run into that person again, that it's going to slow them down a minute, why do they do it? They do it because of kindness, right? Maybe they think, well, down the road, karma is going to, you know, serve it back. But at that moment, they made the decision to be genuinely kind. So that's, I think that's where I see it in my daily life. I see the competition. I see the backbiting. I see the nastiness. I see the aggression. And then I go to my lab, and I was talking about this before the show, but I go to my lab, which is full of students who should be all competing with each other to get ahead because they're all trying to get into graduate school, get scholarships. And I watch them cooperate, you know, and I watch them sharing the fame on a project that hits the media or, really trying to help each other out with absolutely no expectation of payback. And it's, I think because I study all this negative stuff, when I see the good stuff, it's just like, wow. Like, yeah. So that's what affects me. And yeah, it gives me some reassurance, I guess. That there's good.
That's pretty wonderful. It's, you know, to awesome. To be able to say that you, the thing that you've decided to do for your life brings you such a, such a profound sort of effect on how you see the world.
Oh, it does.
I think that's pretty, pretty miraculous.
I have no regrets. Absolutely no regrets about what I do. I had a friend, and this is going into the me-search side of it now, as I like to call it. I had a friend over, and they're just talking to me about my career, and they're saying, so, you know, you've been doing this for a long time now. Like, when you die, or when you're on your deathbed, what are you going to think about it? And it's going to be like, I have absolutely no regrets. You know, like, I have learned so much. I've changed the field a bit. I've altered the life of a few students. This is a good thing.
I would give you a slow clap for that. I mean, there is like not from, you know, I'm trying to find out little things about my biology and having a hard time on the internet of all places finding anything consistent or reliable. So anytime I hear of anybody doing any kind of study, particularly related to females, I'm like, yes, because there's not enough information.
There's really
out
not.
There.
No.
Marianne, this was fantastic.
Oh, I had fun. I
love this. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you were hoping we would dive into?
Not off the top of my head. I think
I don't want to open a can of worms here.
Go for
but
it.
But you said something like very like you just kind of blew over it, and I wrote it down. I didn't get the whole thing that you said, but it was something about rape.
Gotcha.
Yep. And I'm just curious about that because obviously it's a huge and you work in a university and like we do a lot of episodes talking about consent and all of that kind of stuff. And I just, I'm just curious about what role that plays in, from an evolutionary standpoint.
So there was a book published on rape. Oh, I'm going to date myself here. It was quite a while ago. I'd say about 20 years ago. I can't remember the exact year. And it came out and it was written by two men and it gained a lot of notoriety right away because it basically said that rape is a natural adaptation for some men to engage in, especially men who may not have a chance to find a quality mate or get access to mates.
Got it.
And the feminist scholars, I'd say, had a very critical negative reaction to their argument, understandably, I feel. And I think, first of all, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what their arguments were. And they, one of the things was that they weren't saying all men naturally rape, right? So we have this thing called the naturalistic fallacy, which we stole and mutated from philosophy. But it means that just because we study something doesn't mean that it ought to be. So just because something is doesn't mean it ought, right? Which is a huge thing in evolutionary psychology. So going back to the issue of rape then, when this book came out, it caused the storm. And one of the best accounts I saw in response to it was that in order to explain rape as an evolutionary adaptation, you also have to explain why some men do not rape and why indeed it's the majority of men, even with an opportunity to rape freely and all these other things, why they do not. And I thought, and it was Franz de Waal that said that, who's a famous primatologist. And I thought, yeah, like he's nailed it. Like if you're going to make an argument that men have a propensity to do something, you also have to argue why they do not engage in that.
And there was no answer to that?
There's been no answer.
Right.
So that's as far as it's really gotten. And you could talk about how, you know, the social-emotional aspects of it, too. And I've fallen, I have to admit, and this is probably going to get me some trouble with the evolutionary psychologist, I've fallen into the camp of if you can't explain why it doesn't happen more often, then you have to go back to the drawing board. And I don't think their arguments, as they've published them, about being a natural adaptation are correct. Mm. But I'm glad, the one thing I am happy for, and this is the stuff that gets me in trouble all the time, is I'm happy they raised the issue, because at least it got a discussion going. And even though I think it caused a lot of negative reactions in some of the readers of the book and some of the scholars, I'm happy that it got brought to light, you know, rather than it being something that, well, we can't talk about, mm-hmm. you know, and these trigger points and all this sort of stuff. So I like the fact that that's out there and that it's debatable, you know. And but yeah, as for my own reactions to it, not the highlight of evolutionary psychology, in my opinion, but mm-hmm. it's there.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, I would love to know who you would recommend reading, like, to anybody who's interested.
Well, I have a new book that's going to come out soon.
Oh. Oh, plug away.
Well, actually, I don't know. I'm still waiting for the book contract. We'll see if it gets taken up. But I'm hoping to write, they're called Very Short Introductions. Okay. And it's Oxford University Press. So it'd be a 130-page book about the field. And we'll see if I get the contract or not. But that would be my plan for the next few years to do that. But I can tell you who inspired me, and that was really a combination of Ann Campbell, who just passed away, sadly. But she wrote a great book about women in competition and aggression, and it's called A Mind of Her Own. It's fantastic. And the other book I'd really recommend, well, anything by Sarah Hurdy, I think, is fabulously written. But the one that really helped me was The Woman That Never Evolved, and Hurdy spelled H-R-D-Y, Sarah Blaffer Hurdy. Those two are fantastic. David Buss has also written some very populist accounts that are popular. Well, that's sort of redundant. I guess popular accounts that are noteworthy. Like Evolution of Desire is a classic. And that's one of the books I read when I moved into the field. And Helen Fisher, no relation. She's famous. It's crazy. No relationship. I'm quite envious. But she's written some great work as well in the past. So those are some maybe go-to points. But yeah.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much
for
coming in. And thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week with another fantastic,
sexy,
amazing, all those episode.
All the adjectives.
And in the meantime, it would mean the world to us if you headed on over to iTunes or Apple Podcasts and left us a rating and a review. And subscribe, for sure. Hit that subscribe button. It helps us stay on the iTunes charts, which is great for us and for you. And you can find us on social media.
Instagram, Facebook,
Twitter, all that crap. And
check out our website, blog posts from past guests, and submission forms if you're interested in being a guest, or if you have a question you would like us to take a stab at. I think that's it. Until next week,
go fuck yourself.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.